of them. She used to distribute gifts in Macthar, food and coin for the needy. Yet they cheered as she was led to the stake. We heard that in Pertia. And they screamed in rage when you robbed them of their sport. What makes people act like that? How could they be so cruel, so evil? He shook his head. How can I answer? Some weeks ago a slave boy ran away after I had bought him as a gift for the Duke. I hunted him down, and when he'd almost escaped, I loosed an arrow into his back. Why? How can any man answer? He was mine. He disobeyed me. I watched him crawl into the forest to die alone. It's been on my mind ever since. I cannot justify it. No more could any man present, when Dianu died, justify his passions. Are you sure the boy died? No, but the arrow went deep. For a while they sat in silence. Then Shearer spoke again. It is hard to believe how soon the world can change. I spent 4 years in Firbolg, attending school, enjoying feasts and dances and banquets. I even met the king. He was tall and not old, but his eyes were strange and cold. I did not like him, nor his new knights. Many rumors sprang up about them. Some men said they were demons from another world. Others claimed they were sorcerers who sacrificed living victims on a secret altar. Then the fear began. The arrests, the executions, the mobs chanting in the streets. I used to walk along the perfumed path at night. You recall it? Yes, he said. A haunt for lovers. Roses and many other flowers lined the path all the way to the royal park. No one used it during my last year in Firbolg. 4 women disappeared while walking it. 2 others were attacked and raped. It became a place of fear. And the murders and robberies. Not a day passed without word of some new outrage. But even that was not enough to concern the nobility. Then one evening, at the palace, everything changed. The king had ordered a special feast. We arrived late and saw that the palace hall was packed with beds and couches, and everywhere people were rutting. The slave at the door told my uncle that no man was allowed to remain with his wife. All had to find other partners. We slipped away then, and that's when my uncle sent me to Dianu, and our plan to escape was formed. The king turned the palace into a brothel, exclaimed Erin, and the nobles stood for it. 4 who refused to take part were later accused of treachery. That's when the king's champion, Elladan, left his service and challenged the Red Knight, Kerbra. We were already on the road by then, but we heard of the fight. Yes, said Erin softly. Kerbra told me of it. The world has thrown away its sanity. Not the whole world, Erin. Only the Gabala. Perhaps Cartain will raise an army strong enough. No, he will not, said Shearer fiercely. Cithaeron is far away. And anyway, there is already an army here. You have heard of Hlor Givers. Now is the time, Erin. Not in 1 year or 10 years. Now. But the man is a peasant. You can't be serious. A peasant? I would sooner be ruled by an honest peasant than a mad king. But his army would grow even faster if men like you were allied to him. Erin shook his head. I have heard many stories of the legendary wife-killer. But I've never seen this army. What would it consist of? Killers? Thieves? Robbers? Would these put an end to King Ahak's reign of terror, or add to it?
When I was a child, said Shearer, there was a fire on the estate. Our foresters set another blaze before it, burning all the ground in its path. The first fire was starved and died, and the land was safe. Within a few years, you would never have known there had been two fires.
Obadiah entered the cave. No good, he said. Horse bolted, and I saw wolf tracks. We walk now.
Back to Pertia? Inquired Shearer softly.
No, said Erin. We'll find Chlor Givis. Better and better, grunted Obadiah. Chapter 12.
Lamfada lay in a warm corner of the cabin, covered by a thick woolen blanket, his head resting on an embroidered cushion. He could hear Elladan and Gwydion talking in low voices, but the sound washed over him as he reached for the yellow. He was anxious to see which color approached the edge of his vision. Would he be a healer, or a wizard, or a seer, or a craftsman? He closed his eyes, drawing the yellow to him and feeling its warmth. His body lost all sensation of weight, and he seemed to be floating effortlessly in a warm sea, slowly rolling over and over, yet rising into the glow above. Often he had reached this stage, but mostly he remained a little below it, bathing in the yellow. Tonight he rose and rose, seeking the color of his life. The yellow deepened into gold, and his eyes snapped open to see the sky was ablaze with color, red, green, white, blue, black, violet, and gold. They merged and swelled together, and he felt himself on a river of magic, whirling above the forest. At first he was frightened and struggled to return, but the gold brought him tranquility, and he fastened to it. And from the darkest, deepest corner of the Hall of Memory came the realization that he had touched the gold once before, as a 9-year-old child torn by grief at the death of his mother. He remembered the hooded man chanting on the hill, and he knew him as Rued Rofessa, the wizard Olathair. But there was another man close by, he recalled, a man who had sent the frightened boy home. Yet his name was still lost to Lamfada. His headlong flight slowed as he reached the edge of the forest. Gazing down at himself, he saw he was naked, and standing on a golden circle. Far below him lay the trees, and he could see a stag running on a hillside, pursued by wolves. He shivered, afraid that he would fall from the circle, wishing it had walls. The circle curved up into a half-sphere, and he sat back on a high seat. This was wondrous beyond his dreaming. On the hillside, the stag had turned to face the pack. Lamfada watched as it lowered its head. A wolf leapt, only to be hurled into the air. A second wolf moved in behind the stag, then another. Their fangs tore at the animal and the stag fell, its throat ripped, blood spilling to the earth. Lamfada was struck by a terrible sadness, and the golden sphere dropped to the earth. Frightened by the light, the wolves ran off. Lamfada stepped from the sphere and approached the dead stag. It was old, its fur grey around the mouth. The boy knelt by it and reached out, but his hand passed through the beast, and he remembered that it was his spirit that flew. Golden light flamed from his hand, filling the body of the stag. The wounds closed, and the grey hairs vanished. Old, stretched muscles swelled with youth and vitality. The stag's head came up, it surged to its feet, and with one leap it bounded from the hilltop. The wolves closed in, but its speed carried it clear as it ran for the sanctuary of the distant trees. Lamfada climbed into the sphere and took to the skies, joy flooding him. At the edge of the forest once more, he gazed out over the realm beyond and saw the red gathering like a distant sunset. He sensed another presence and saw a man hovering in the sky. He was dressed in red armor, and his hair was glittering white in the moonlight. And yet as Lamfada looked closer, he saw the night was almost transparent.
Who are you?
asked Lamphada. Blood-red eyes turned on him, and the knight tried to fly closer. But the gold turned him back.
I am Kerbera, the knight whispered. And you?
Lamphada, why are you here?
To see, to learn. Are you with Law Givers?
Yes. Do you know him?
The knight smiled.
I will know him. Soon. His pitiful little army will see the power of the new Gabala. Tell him I said this. Tell him the king is coming in the spring with all his soldiers. Tell him there is nowhere to hide from the red knights.
He would not hide, said Lamphada. He will not fear you.
All creatures of flesh and blood should fear me, declared Kerbera, and all who ride with me. You, boy, what is the source of your magic?
I do not know, said Lamphada warily. I am new to the colors.
There is only one color of importance, snapped the knight.
You speak of the red, yet it cannot heal.
Heal? It can create a form that needs no healing. Why do I talk to you? Begone, boy. I have no wish to slay you.
Are you in pain?
Asked Lamphada suddenly.
Are you ill?
Kerbera's eyes flashed and he dragged his sword from its ghostly scabbard, swinging the blade at the golden sphere. But the sword bounced back, and Kerbera's face grew ever more pale. He dropped the sword, which floated by his side.
Kill me, he said. Come on, boy, kill me.
Why? Why should I do such a terrible thing?
Terrible. You have no idea of the meaning of the word. But you will, when we come for you in the spring. Tell Chlor Givers you saw me. Tell him.
I will. Why do you hate him?
Hate? I do not hate him, boy. I hate myself. To all else, I am indifferent.
The knight turned away and grew ever more transparent. Then suddenly he turned, his body bathed in brilliant red.
Olothair! He cried. You come from Olothair!
Lamphada shrank back, and a wall of golden light sprang between them. The knight began to laugh.
Oh, this is rich. Go to him. Send him my regards. Kerbera Pateus sends greetings.
And then he was gone. Lamphada fled for the cabin and the safety of his body. He awoke with a start, wondering if he had dreamt his flight, yet he could still see the burning eyes of the knight. He sat up. In the opposite corner lay Elladan, fast asleep. Gwydion still sat at the table, staring into a goblet. Lamphada rose.
Can you not sleep? Asked the healer.
May I speak with you, sir?
Why not? There is little else to occupy us.
I have found my color.
Gwydion's eyes sparkled and he clapped Lamphada's shoulder.
That is good. I hope it is green. The world has need of healers.
It is gold.
There is no gold, boy. You are still in the yellow.
No, sir. I floated in a golden boat and saw an ancient stag die. I gave it life, and it rose.
Pah! What you had was a dream, but it sounds a damn fine one.
Lamphada shook his head.
Wait, let me try again.
He closed his eyes and reached for the colors. The yellow welcomed him, but of the gold there was no sign.
Do not be disheartened, lad, said Gwydion. These things take time. What else did you see?
I saw a red knight floating at the edge of the forest. He gave me a message for Olothair. He said, Kerbera Pateus sends greetings.
Gwydion recoiled, the color draining from his face.
Do not deliver that message. Do not speak of it. Do not even think of it.
I don't understand.
And that's as it should be. But trust me, Lampfader. Say nothing. It was just a dream. Just a very bad dream.
Ubadai knelt by the body that lay across the trail. It had six legs and was covered in scaled skin. The jaws were longer than a man's arm and were rimmed with three rows of teeth.
I've never seen anything like it, declared Erin. And there's not a wound on it.
Ubadai placed his hand on the creature's chest.
All muscle, he stated. No fat. This one frees to death.
They had many strange beasts in the zoo at Firbolg, said Shearer. Perhaps someone was transporting more from the coast, and they escaped.
Ubadai shrugged. Maybe. But I grew to manhood on the steppes, and I never heard of a lizard with six legs. We should find a safe place to camp. The sun goes down. Maybe more beasts.
Warily they stepped around the carcass and continued on up a winding trail. At the top of the hill, the path widened and split, one trail leading to the east, the other south. Ubadai sniffed the air.
That way, he said, pointing east.
Erin was too tired and cold to argue. He hitched his saddlebags to his left shoulder and walked on. After another quarter of a mile, they came to a bend in the trail, and there ahead of them was a small stone-built house, nestling against the side of a sheer rock wall. Before it, on the snow, sat an old man in faded blue robes. His head was bald and round, but a white forked beard grew to his chest.
Is he dead?
Erin asked, as Ubadai approached the man. The old man's eyes opened.
No, I am not dead, he snapped. I was thinking. I was enjoying the solitude.
My apologies, offered Erin, bowing low. But are you not cold sitting there?
What has my condition to do with you? This is my home, and this is my body. If it is cold, that is its own affair.
Indeed it is, sir, agreed Erin, forcing a smile. Look, my companions and I are in need of shelter. Could we prevail upon you to allow us to spend the night in your home?
I do not like company, the old man replied. Then sit out here in the snow, said Ubadai. He turned to Erin. Why waste time on a stupid old fool? Let's get inside.
No, said Erin. We will find a cave or something.
The old man grinned.
I've changed my mind, he announced. You may stay. I expect you will want to light a fire. There is no wood, and you'll need to gather some. I believe there is an old axe inside.
Ubadai muttered something under his breath and strode into the house, emerging moments later with the weapon. Erin bowed once more to the man sitting in the snow.
Why did you change your mind? He asked.
Because I am capricious by nature. Now go away and let me think.
Erin and Shearer moved into the dwelling. There was only one large room, neatly laid out with a bed in one corner, and a table with two bench seats set in the center. The hearth was cold and empty, and there was sign of neither cooking utensils nor food of any kind.
I'll gather some tinder, said Shearer.
Nodding, Erin dumped his saddlebags against the wall. The stone house was colder than death. Ice had formed on the northern wall, where water had flowed through a crack in the roof. He walked over to the bed, where a single threadbare blanket was casually laid. There was no mattress, merely a line of wooden slats. Erin looked around. The room was stark and inhospitable. He walked out into the gathering dusk, skirted the seated figure and joined Shira in her wood gathering. In the distance, they could hear the steady thud of the axe. For some while they gathered what dead wood could be found and carried it into the house. Shira started a fire, but its warmth took an age to penetrate the grim cold of the dwelling. Ubadiah came in after an hour, and threw the axe against the far wall. His face was red and shining with sweat.
"Need help," he muttered.
Erin and Shira followed him to a clearing where he had cut down a dead tree, and reduced it to manageable chunks and sections. It was dark by the time they had ferried the fuel to the house, and the fire was blazing brightly in the hearth. The trio sat round the blaze long into the night, and every once in a while, Erin would rise, walk to the door and stare out into the moonlight, where the old man was still sitting. It had begun to snow. At last, Erin went out to where he sat and squatted down in front of him.
"Excuse me, sir."
The man's dark eyes opened.
"You again? What is it now? You have the house. What more do you want?"
"Are you trying to die?"
"What if I am? I know that is your own business, but the house is now warm and I would feel more comfortable if you joined us. Perhaps we could talk. Death is very rarely an answer to anything." "Don't be foolish, boy. Death is the final answer to everything. It is the end of every journey. It is peace and an end to strife."
"Yes," Erin agreed. "But it is also an end to laughter and joy, to companionship, to love. And most of all, it is an end to dreams and hopes."
"Ah, yes. But then death holds no terrors for a man without dreams and hopes. Has it occurred to you that the more we love, the greater is our sadness? For ultimately all things end. No dream is ever completely fulfilled."
"Could it not be said the other way around?" offered Erin. "The greater our sadness, the greater our joy. How can we recognize one without the counterbalance of the other?"
"Answer me this, young debater. If a man loves a woman for 40 years, adores her, lives for her, how great is the pain when she dies and leaves him alone? Given the choice to go back and start again, would he not be wise to avoid the first meeting and live his life without love?"
Erin smiled. "Does a man who lives in winter regret the summer? Would he choose to spend his life in a perennial autumn?" "The argument is not a good one, sir. Come inside and enjoy the fire."
"The fire is immaterial, but I will join you."
The old man rose smoothly, brushed the snow from his clothes and followed Erin inside. Shira was asleep by the fire, and Ubadiah was sharpening the old axe. He looked up at the old man.
"Not dead yet, then," said the nomad.
"Not yet,"
the man agreed. Erin pushed shut the door and walked over to the fire, holding out his hands to the welcoming blaze. He removed his cloak and outer tunic, allowing the heat to wash over him.
"How could you sit there so long?" he asked as the old man sat beside him.
"Feel my hand," said the stranger.
Erin took it and found it was warmer than his own.
"Incredible! How do you do it?"
"He is a wizard," said Ubadiah. "I could have told you this."
"Are you a sorcerer, sir?" asked Erin.
"Of a sort. I am the Dagda, but I cast no spells. You are safe here."
"What form does your magic take?"
"Don't ask," snapped Ubadiah.
"I tell the truth," the Dagda answered,
"and I see all the spinning colors in the circle of life. The past, the present, and all of the futures."
"You tell fortunes," said Erin. "Could you tell mine?"
I could, Lord Erin. I could tell you everything that lies in store for you.
Then do so, please.
No. You see, I like you.
He turned to Ubadai.
But you I will tell. Should you desire it? Bah, not me. You shamans are all alike. Death, despair, and bad luck. You say nothing to me, old man.
Very wise, Ubadai, said the Dagda, smiling. Will you answer me one question? Asked Erin.
Perhaps.
Can the king's evil be defeated?
You are sure Ahak is evil?
Do you see his deeds as good?
Countered Erin. We are talking of the man who led the last victorious army and successfully negotiated a peaceful end to the days of empire. We are talking about the king who introduced legal reforms to aid the poor, who set up a special tax so that food could be distributed among the poverty-stricken. Have you forgotten the free medicines for the sick and needy?
I have not forgotten, replied Erin, but nor can I forget the massacre of the nomads, nor the disgusting events now taking place in the capital.
And what does that tell you?
That the king has become evil.
Indeed, Lord Erin, it does. But the important word is become. There is something that has entered the realm, corrupting all it touches.
I have no knowledge of that, said Erin softly. But from wherever it comes, can it be defeated?
The answer must be yes. Most evil springs from the hearts of men, and all men must die, and therefore their evil dies with them. But your question was perhaps more specific. Can this evil be destroyed swiftly by Lord Givis? The answer, as we sit here, is no.
But it could change, pressed Erin.
There are many futures, and every man has an opportunity to fashion his own. The colours are shifting, the harmony gone. But yes, it could change. You see, the success or failure of your venture depends on the whim of a thief and a murderer.
Lord Givers?
No. Get some sleep, Lord Erin. In the morning I will be gone. Rest here until you are ready to leave. Then travel east. You will find the man you seek.
And where will you go?
Wherever I choose,
answered the Dagda. Groundsel found himself strangely reluctant to part with the golden-haired child he had carried from the blizzard. But once the refugees had been found quarters in the stockade, an elderly woman approached him, naming herself as the girl's grandmother. The child's name was Evi, and Groundsel felt both pain and gratification as she wept when her grandmother took her to the makeshift huts being erected against the north wall. He watched from the doorway as the old woman and the child made their way across the snow, waving when Evi looked back. Arion saw him there and joined him.
It's going to be very crowded here for a while, she said. I think I'll make my way back home.
There's another blizzard coming, he told her, pointing to the lowering sky. 2 or 3 days, and it should be safe for a journey. Come inside and share a goblet of wine. It's good. 10 years old.
Without waiting for a response, he moved back into the hall and wandered to a blazing fire. For a moment, Arion stood in the doorway, unsure. But she was lonely. Chlor avoided her company and now Nuada was living with the dark-eyed refugee Cartier. Removing her sheepskin cloak, she went over to the fire, accepting a silver goblet filled with blood-red wine. She sipped it and sat facing Groundsel.
An old woman like that is no guardian for a child. She may not last the winter, he said, staring into the dancing flames.
You would be a better mother?
His dark eyes swung on her.
Do not mock me, girl,
he hissed. She swallowed hard.
I'm sorry. I did not mean it the way it sounded.
He shrugged, and the anger faded from his gaze.
Truth in it, though. I couldn't raise a child. I wouldn't know how. But you could.
I'll have children of my own, when I'm ready.
I don't doubt it. You've the hips for it. But that's not what I meant. You could stay here, with me. We could raise the child, and some of our own. There is no better catch for you in the forest. I have everything here. And when I am ready, I'll sail for Cithaeron. And by the gods, I'll be one of the richest men there.
Arion took a sip of wine, her mind racing.
How could this ugly ape believe that she would marry him?
The thought of him touching her made her feel ill. Yes, he was strong, and yes, he would undoubtedly become rich with his thieving and slaying. But a partner for life?
I have no love for you, she said,
at last, bracing herself for his anger. But his response surprised her.
Love? You believe it is an arrow from heaven? It is not. I've seen men and women without love living contented lives. Anyway, love is something that grows through companionship. I do not love you, Arion. I desire you. But that is a beginning, and I know what you see when you look at Grounsel. I'm not blind. I'm not tall and handsome like Hlorgivis, nor a talented wordsmith like Nuada. But I'm strong, and I'll still be here when they are long dead.
No, she said. I could not marry you. You talk of desire as a beginning. I believe that, and I do not desire you. Your wealth does not interest me, nor a life of riches in Cithaeron. I wish I could say this in a manner less hurtful, but I'm not clever with words.
He nodded, his face showing no emotion. Then he smiled.
For most of my life, I was denied all that I desired. When I broke away and came here, I decided that never again would I be denied anything. I've asked for your hand, as a man should. But I will have you, Arion, with or without your consent. So take a few days to think over my proposal.
I do not like being threatened, she said, eyes blazing. And if you think to take me, think again. I will kill you.
You think you could?
Suddenly she laughed.
Take me to your bed, Grounsel. But be careful never to sleep.
It might still be worth it, he told her.
You'll never know, she retorted, rising.
Sweeping her cloak over her shoulders, she moved back into the daylight. Snow was falling fast as she trudged towards her hut. As she approached it, she saw two sentries pulling open the main gates and watched as they bowed to an old man in faded robes of dyed blue wool. His head was bald, but a long forked white beard flowed to his chest. The sentries backed away from him, and Arion stood transfixed. The stranger seemed to float over the snow, leaving barely a trace of footsteps. He stopped in the center of the village and sat down in the snow. One of the sentries ran to him, bringing him bread. Other villagers came from their homes and clustered around him. Puzzled by the commotion, Arion strolled over, and Hlorgivis joined her.
What is he doing?
Asked Arion, as the old man spread out some 30 black stones on the packed snow before him. Hlor grinned.
You have heard of him, Arion. Now is your chance to see. He is the Dagda. Have you the courage to question him?
She glanced up into his mocking gaze.
I'll follow you, she said.
But he shook his head. I have no wish to know the future. And I have not the skill to question the old man. He knows it all, right up to the moment of every death.
He'll freeze sitting there, she said.
Chlor turned, then tapped Arion's shoulder, pointing to the hall. Groundsel was walking forward, bearing a heavy sheepskin cloak. It's part of the ritual in any village he stops in. He will wait for the headman to invite him to his quarters. Very few will refuse.
Why? Does he curse them? She asked.
Worse than that, he tells them the truth. The crowd parted for Groundsel, who bowed to the Dagda. The old man gathered his black stones, tipping them into a leather pouch. Then he rose and accepted the cloak. The crowd followed as Groundsel led the way to the warmth of the hall.
Would you like to see his skills in action? Asked Chlor.
Arion nodded. Inside the hall, a space was cleared by one of the fires. Once again the old man squatted down and spread the stones. He looked up at Groundsel, who shook his head. The crowd stirred. Groundsel pointed to Arion, waving her forward. Chlor came with her, and they sat before the Dagda.
You first, said Arion,
and Chlor cleared his throat. The Dagda gave a thin smile.
Pick 8 of the stones, he said,
his voice hissing like a wind through the branches of a dead tree. Chlor looked down at them. They were flat and mostly round, obviously gathered from a stream bed. Slowly he picked his 8, then the old man turned them over one by one, examining the different runes on each. His pale eyes came up.
Ask me of your life, Chlor Givis.
Chlor swallowed.
I do not know what to ask, Dagda, he muttered, reddening.
Then shall I tell you all?
No, snapped Chlor. All men die. I have no wish to know the time and the place. Tell me if we will have a good spring, with game aplenty.
The spring will be fine, said the Dagda with another thin smile. It will come early, and the game will be more than plentiful. But you will have little time to hunt, Chlor Givis, for your enemies are gathering, and they will be here as the snows melt.
I have no enemies, stated Chlor.
Your enemies are terrible. Men of awesome evil. They fear you, Chlor. They fear your army, and they fear your name. They must destroy you, and they will come to you with bright swords and dark magic.
Then I shall leave for Citheron. Let them come here.
You will never see Citheron, Chlor Givis.
Can I defeat these enemies?
All men can suffer defeat. I see 2 armies. Do you wish to know the outcome?
No. Thank you for your counsel.
The Dagda smiled and turned to Arion. He turned the stones and spread them under his long, bony fingers. She chose her 8 and waited.
Ask, Arion, and I shall enlighten you.
Will Chlor win? She asked.
Chlor cursed and pushed himself to his feet, but before he could retreat out of hearing, the old man's voice sounded.
I see him lifeless on the ground before the forest, and a demon stalking the hill, the red demon with a dark sword.
You foolish child, snapped Chlor, his angry eyes fixed on Arion. A curse on you!
He strode from the hall, and Groundsel knelt by Arion.
Ask him about us, he whispered.
Her face white, Arion shook her head.
I don't want to know any more. I'm sorry, Dagda.
As she tried to rise to follow Chlor, Groundsel held her arm.
Ask him! I will abide by what he says.
She shook herself loose and took a deep breath.
Tell me of Groundsel, she whispered.
The outlaw leader blanched.
He too will die in the spring.
I see a horse, a white horse, and a rider in shining silver, and a child on a hillside. The demons are gathering, and the great storm will descend on the forest. But Groundsel will not see it.
What should we do?
Arion asked.
Whatever you will.
The Hlor have to die.
All creatures die. Some die well, others badly.
He looked up at Groundsel.
Would you like to hear more, my new Lord Groundsel?
I never asked you about me, but for years you've been longing to tell me, you bastard. Well, I'll outlive you, and when this shining silver rider comes to me, I'll kill him too. I do not believe you, Dagda. Nothing is written in those stones that a strong man cannot change. I will make my own decisions.
Indeed you will. Think on that point when you meet the Silver Rider.
The old man turned his attention to Arion.
You asked what to do. I do not advise. I merely tell what is. But I see a one-handed swordsman and a child of power. I see a craftsman, a wizard with a burden. All must come together. A balance must be restored.
Arion left him then and made her way to Hlor's hut, desperate to apologize. She had not meant to ask the question. It had sprung from her concern. Surely he would be able to understand. But Hlor's hut was empty, his belongings gone. She ran to the gate and climbed the ladder to the rampart. Fresh snow was falling, but she could see his footsteps leading away into the darkness of the forest. Hlor Givis pushed on until an hour before dusk, ploughing his slow way through drifts, down icy slopes and across frozen streams, determined to put as much distance between himself and the Dagda as possible. The man was a grim legend to the forest. None knew where he lived, but stories of his travels claimed he had walked the forest of the ocean for more than a century. Some said he was a former knight, others that he was a priest, but all agreed his words were double-edged. Yet still men and women clamored to hear of their futures, dark or bright, joy-filled or pain-born. At dusk, Hlor had a fire going against the fallen trunk of an old birch. He'd built a snow wall to the north, to shelter him from the bitter wind, and settled down to sit out the night.
Damn the girl! Death in the spring, lifeless before an army of enemies he had never courted. What unlucky star had he been born under? Which god had he offended to have his life so ruined? First Lydia, and that blow had been savage, and now a meaningless death.
The stars were bright, the temperature dropping as Hlor built up the fire and gathered his cloak around him. A whisper of movement came from the undergrowth, and he drew his axe from his belt and swung his head. Sitting some 15 feet from the fire, and gazing at him with baleful eyes, was a huge grey wolf. In the light from the blaze, Hlor could see that his muzzle was white. He was old and cast from the pack. From the size of the scarred shoulders, Hlor guessed he had once been the leader of the pack, but like all creatures, age had withered his strength, and a younger male had forced him aside. Hlor reached into his pack, pulling out a section of dried beef which he tossed to the wolf. The beast ignored it. Hlor looked away and added more wood to the blaze. When he looked back, the meat was gone, but the wolf still sat.
"Proud, are you?" said Hlor. "No bad thing, in man or beast."
He tossed another chunk of meat, this time a little closer. Once more, the wolf waited until he looked away before scooping the meat into its jaws. There were few recorded instances of wolves attacking men, and Hlor was not worried about his ability to kill the beast. His axe was sharp, his arm strong. But he was glad of the company. "Come, Grey One, enjoy the fire." A Another piece of beef landed before the wolf, but to his right, bringing him closer to the warmth. As he moved to the morsel, Chlor saw the marks of recent combat on the gnarled shoulders, jagged fang marks deep along the flank. An old scar could still be seen on his right hind leg, causing him to limp.
You won't survive the winter, Grey One. Even a tired rabbit could outrun you.
And you'll bring down no stags. Best you stay with me for a while. The wolf settled down on his haunches, grateful for the heat and his first meal in 10 days. The wound on his hind leg had been caused in the summer, when a huge brown bear had attacked his mate. He had charged the beast and leapt for his throat, but the thick fur had prevented his fangs from sinking home, and a swipe from the bear's talons had opened a long wound in his side. His mate had died, and his own wound had been long in the healing. When the pack had gathered for the winter, the challenges had come, as they always did. But he had neither the strength nor the will to withstand them. They had driven him from them many days ago. He had lived on carrion and the leavings of other carnivores. Then, with his strength almost gone, he had smelt the man and had been gathering himself to attack him. Now he was unsure. But the meat was good, the fire warm. He settled down warily, his yellow eyes fixed on the man, his hunger now less keen. Chlor delved into his pack. There were 3 more pieces of meat. He pulled 2 of them clear and bit into one. The wolf's head came up and he threw the 2nd piece to it. This time the animal ate it at once. Adding fresh wood, Chlor settled down beside the fire. He did not fear an attack from the wolf. How could he? Did not the Dagda say he had until the spring? He slept without dreams and awoke in the chill of the morning. The fire had died down to glowing embers, and the wolf had gone. Chlor felt a sense of loss. He sat up, shivered, and stoked the fire to life, adding twigs he had gathered the previous afternoon. Then he took a copper pot from his pack and filled it with snow, placing it at the edge of the fire. As the snow melted, he added fresh handfuls until the pot was half full with water. Into this he mixed some dried oats, stirring with a stick until it thickened. The words of the Dagda haunted him still. His enemies were gathering, and he could not avoid them. That left the former blacksmith only one option. He would attempt what the legend said he had already achieved. He would build an army. He would take the war to them. But how? How could a blacksmith raise such a force? He chuckled. Start with one, Chlor. Find one man. Then another. The forest is full of rebels. His thoughts went to Elladan, the former knight. He at least was versed in the ways of war. And the wizard who had helped Lamphada, he too could be a help. Chlor ate the hot oats, doused the fire, and set off to the east. Chapter 13. The Duke was mildly drunk as he sat on the ramparts, gazing out over the snow-covered countryside. An iron brazier had been set up beside him, but the glowing coals barely countered the freezing wind. Far in the distance, he could just make out the black line of the forest. Beyond it, he could picture the sea and the trade route to Severon. The dawn sky was clear, and the doves were waking around the tower, wheeling and diving. The Duke shivered and held out his hands to the coals. 3 days ago, he had still nursed hopes of riding the storm of the new age. But then the king had arrived with 1,000 riders. The audience had been short, and when the Duke was summoned to his own hall, there had been a Kessa sitting at the king's right, and flanking the throne were the 8 demonic red knights. The Duke had bowed low.
"This is a troublesome duchy," said Ahak, lord of the realm, captain of 10,000 lances. The Duke looked up into his red-rimmed eyes and could find no words. The shock of the king's appearance, white-haired and grey of face, unnerved him.
Well, have you nothing to say, kinsman?
I am heartbroken that you are distressed, my liege. Perhaps the reports have been unnecessarily alarming. We have identified all of nomad birth. Our taxes are collected and have been dispatched to Firbolg. Where is the problem?
Ahak shook his head and turned to Okessa.
Where is the problem, he asks. Is he slow-witted?
Okessa shrugged and smiled, and the king swung on the duke.
Where? Is this not the castle from which the rebel Hlog Givis made his escape? To form his rebellious army in that cursed forest? Is this not the duchy that saw your own lord of the feast, a man you recommended should supervise my visit and attend my person turned traitor?
Okessa leaned towards the king and whispered something in his ear.
Ah, yes, hissed Ahak. And what of this wizard Olifair, who was allowed to escape? And you do not see where the problem lies?
My liege, I cannot dispute we have suffered misfortunes, but the man Hlog Givers was just a blacksmith who killed his wife. And yes, he escaped. But of the men who escaped with him, all but a mere handful were recaptured. And as for Erin, I blame the Lord Okessa for provoking him at the council. The man was concerned about a woman he loved. A nomad bitch! Who knows what foul treason they would have plotted? I'm displeased with you, kinsman, but I will consider what action to take when I have studied your duchy at close quarters. Go now.
Dismissed from his own hall, he had not been summoned to the king's presence since then. But he had seen others who were. 2 nights ago, 3 young women from the village had been led into the courtyard by one of Okessa's servants. An hour later, as the duke lay in bed unable to sleep, he had heard a terrible scream. The girls had not been seen since that night, but the duke had watched as 3 sacks were carried from the royal quarters, their contents buried behind the stables. The duke had slipped out into the courtyard an hour later and found the fresh-turned earth. Digging his fingers into the ground, he had come up with a small skull which he hastily reburied. The following morning he had ordered his horse saddled for his usual ride across the hills, but was informed by his captain that the Lord Okessa had requested the Duke's presence within the castle in case the king should have need to call on him. He was a prisoner in his own fortress, guarded by his own troops. It was barely credible, but then neither was the change in Ahak. The Duke had always known the king was a ruthless man. 6 years ago, the rumors had been strong that he ordered the poisoning of his uncle, the previous monarch. But in those days, Ahak had been a powerhouse of physical strength, young and in his prime. His hair was raven black, his eyes clear. Once, at a feast, he had lifted a 20-gallon barrel of wine over his head and held it there for 10 heartbeats. Now he was a shadow of the man he had been, and yet, how old could he be? 33? 34? Certainly no more. As the coals in the brazier died down, the Duke returned to his quarters. His servants brought him hot water, and, with the aid of a silver mirror, he shaved carefully around his thin beard, noting the grey hairs that were beginning to appear at his temples. His face was lean and strong, the eyes deep and set close together above a curved nose. Not handsome in you, but powerful. He put down the mirror and rubbed at his face with a warmed towel.
Rebels in the forest. He wished to hell there was a rebel army ready to sweep down.
But all his spies informed him that the legend of Hlog Givis was exactly that, a fable. He smiled ruefully.
Even if the legend were true, and the army swept into Macthar, he would still be a prisoner. He was a hated man. It was a lesson his father had taught him.
"A man can rule using either love or fear," he had said. "But fear is stronger."
And his words had been proved true. But now, as the Duke waited for news of his fate, he knew there was not a man in Macthar who would assist him, and few tears would be shed when his blood ran.
"Breakfast, my lord?"
asked a slave girl whose name the Duke did not know. "No." He looked at the girl. She was young, dark and pretty. He knew he had bedded her at some time in the winter, but could not remember much of the event. He wandered to his bedroom. He was glad he had never married. He had planned to, of course, in order to sire an heir, but had decided to wait until he was 50. At least now he would not have the worry of a family waiting to share his fate. Hearing the thunder of hooves from the courtyard, he walked to the window. 500 of the king's black-cloaked riders were galloping from the castle, and he watched them for a while as they headed for the forest. He summoned his captain.
"Where are they going?" he asked.
"I understand the king has commanded them to enter the forest and ascertain the strength of Lord Givis's army."
"There is no army," snapped the Duke. "They will find a few settlements and they will rape and kill. Gods, the world has gone mad."
The man said nothing. The Duke waved him away.
"Go," he said. "Go and report what I have said. I don't doubt a Kessa will reward you."
The man bowed, moved back, and closed the door. The Duke heard the key turn in the lock. Mananan pushed back the sheets, lifted the girl's arm from his chest, and rolled from the bed. He poured himself a goblet of the golden ambria and watched the sun rise in glory over the mountains. Strength flowed through him, and he swung round to see the girl awake. She smiled at him and sat up.
"How are you feeling, Lord Knight?"
He chuckled and returned to the bed, stroking her shoulder and pushing back the long, flowing hair to kiss her neck. Her skin was ivory pale, her body soft. Arousal swamped him. An hour later he watched her leave and lay back on the bed. Sunlight streamed through the open window, bathing his body, and the music of songbirds came floating from the perfumed gardens below. Mananan drank more of the elixir, then bathed and dressed in robes of blue silk. Wandering to the terrace garden, he strolled there among the blooms and the flowering trees. He found a small group of poets sitting among the camellias, arguing gently with a number of artists on the question of beauty. For a while he listened, but the sound of distant music lured him to a pavilion where women were dancing, and the sun shone with incredible brightness. Olathaer had been right. The tunnel beyond the black gate was a nightmare to chill a man's soul. Glittering eyes in the darkness, the sweat of terror upon his brow. But beyond it was a land of surpassing beauty, and the city the like of which Mananan had never seen. White stone buildings towering over the landscape, wondrous statues lined the streets, and there were gardens everywhere, and woods of flowering trees. He had been met at the city gates by Paulus, a poet and a magister. The man, tall and white-haired, had bowed low.
"Welcome at last, Mananan. It is a blessing for us that you have come."
"You know me?"
he had asked, dismounting.
"Know you, my dear man? Samuel Danach has talked of nothing else. Welcome indeed. He will be delighted to hear of your arrival."
"He is here? Alive?"
"Not here," said Paulus, smiling. "But yes, he is very much alive, as are all your comrades. They chose to remain among the Viri and help us in our troubles. But you are tired from your travels. Follow me to my home,
There you can bathe and take refreshment."
The Magister's home was a palace of exquisite beauty, marble-fronted and surrounded by terraced gardens. Young women came out to greet them, and Manana